गुरवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। गुड मॉर्निंग फ्रॉम श्री अनंदा आश्रम फ्रॉम नॉर्थ कैरोलिना। वेलकम टू ऑल ऑफ यू टू आवर फोर्थ meeting of our series of lectures called Radical Personalism. Today's lecture will be called Reasons to Live and Stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava. Somehow maybe a cryptic title for some, let's see. But as usual, let's make first a brief recap of the topics we studied last week. And the topic was the collective unconscious of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And of course we began describing this notion of unconscious, which finds some sort of parallel in the Gaudiya tradition in the term citta, coming in Western terminology from Carl Jung. And I decided to invoke that particular term also to make the point that we should be open to learn from other disciplines apart from our own tradition, apart from even other mystical traditions. And even we should be open to see ourselves as individuals and traditions through other disciplines which may have something to contribute. Not necessarily because they will replace the sacred revelation or anything, and even if they are to be considered as relative disciplines which won't have the same degree of penetration into reality, that's fine, but it doesn't render them either totally useless. So we should be open to be nourished from whatever can nourish us in our particular path and destination. So we invoke the notion of the unconscious, individual unconscious, collective unconscious, and how this is applicable not only to us as individual members or entities, but also we could see the Sampradaya, if we want to see the Sampradaya as an entity and unto itself, which many social systems have shown how a group is not merely all its parts put together, but it has its own personality, if you will. So in the context of addressing this issue, also we invoke the notion of the shadow, those things that we are ashamed of or we are unaware of, but that they are influencing us the most. And in that connection, the notion of shadow work, also invoked by Carl Jung, which we could call in our tradition Artha Nivritti, which is not merely a byproduct of bhajan and kriya, like just a result of engaging in bhakti, but to embrace the practice with a certain awareness of which are those conscious obstacles and unconscious elements that are there somehow there in our more subtle invisible dimensions. And we mentioned how this idea regarding the shadow and shadow work, the notion is not to attack the shadow, but to learn to acknowledge it and integrate it and perceive whatever hidden motivations may be there. Like how to do it. Sometimes the question making how to deal with those hidden motivations. Well, if you have to find something which is hidden, we were speaking the other day, like if I hide a gulab jamun in the room, and you have to find it. You don't see it, it's hidden, but you know it's somewhere. So you will pay special attention when looking for that. You will pay some attention in directions and in ways that you never paid attention before. And that may help you to connect with those things that were hidden. And of course, regarding dealing with our unconscious, an important point is that first and foremost, we have to deal with our conscious, with those things that we are conscious of. And that we know the need to be addressed, and probably we are not doing all that we can do to deal with them. So first we have to deal with that conscious layer, and then, if you will, make place for the unconscious to manifest whenever we have properly embraced the conscious platform. So in this way, we can apply all these notions to us as an individual, or we can apply this to the Gaudiya Sampradaya as some sort of global entity. And we can ask ourselves these questions. Is there any shadow work to do as Sampradaya? Is there any unresolved trauma that we may also have in our timeline, in our history? Which are those things that keep us, that keep informing our present and future, which probably are connected to unresolved past? So we extended that invitation, which is, of course, here I'm just sharing some musings. I'm not extending to you some conclusive last word on this topic, and there are so many ways of addressing this type of situation. So here just a small contribution. But the invitation is to engage in collective introspection about what we can do, how we can offer ourselves in a better way to our Sampradaya. We call that collective introspection Sankirtan, actually, because Sankirtan is not merely chanting of the holy names, but doing that from a certain disposition of mind. Sankirtan Yajna, to enter the fire, tapa of introspection in a collective way, some to think together how we can better spread the glories of our tradition, Kirtan. So Sankirtan Yajna, another way of translating that will be collective introspection. If not, the Kirtan may be more musical than mystical. And this Sankirtan is a very deep tradition when properly engaged, as we have seen in Mahaprabhu, our bare deity. It can create so much movements in our heart. And ours is a tradition of tears in that connection. Mahaprabhu cried and cried. But we should ask ourselves, which are the types of tears that I should embrace in my particular stage? So we were speaking how weeping, properly weeping in connection to unresolved stuff from the past, from wounds that need addressing, weeping for that is the middle point between blaming and denying. Instead of blaming circumstances of people or being in total denial, let's weep. Let's acknowledge, let's embrace the wound. Let's use the wound to heal us, as we mentioned, instead of trying to heal the wound. Instead of trying to heal the wound as soon as possible, let's let the wound heal us, and not necessarily as soon as possible, but as long as it needs to take for that to happen. Let's descend first before trying to ascend, because our tradition, of course, is transcendental and it speaks about very deep levels of penetration into transcendence. But before transcending, before ascending, first we need to descend. We need to speak a language of descent. And when I say descend, I mean we have to ground ourselves as individuals, as tradition, in so many ways. So we can, from that proper foundation, ascend and transcend. Because if not, we will just pass trauma, unresolved trauma, to our next generation. Sometimes in the name even of parampara. But of course, parampara has not to do with that type of transmission. That's not parampara. Parampara, in one sense, is not to pass unresolved trauma to a new generation who is dealing with their own unresolved trauma, but passing resolved trauma, among many other things, of course, not limiting parampara to that, but among some things, parampara will be passing the resolved trauma of its present members in the form of new insects and experiences, so the next generations can be better equipped to deal with their own generational trauma. And in that sense, we have to become generative. We use that term from Erik Erikson, generative persons. Not someone who only generates stuff, but who is concerned with the next generations. Generative. And who is living in past, present, and future. And in this way, try to contribute to our movement so the movement keeps growing and expanding. And remember, for the movement to grow means our heart has to grow. Our hearts are the headquarters of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And if the heart grows, the Gaudiya Sampradaya keeps moving and evolving. So we are concerned with transformation, not only with transmitting. Sometimes we may be trained to transmit, but we have to be trained to transform ourselves to begin with, to belong in the proper way, if we make a play of words with belong, and not mere fitting in, not mere passing dogma, but providing the mind to digest the dogma. Again, that's also parampara, not only giving a teaching, a notion, but facilitating the type of mind that will be able to deal with those notions, so we can digest that. So that's what we saw last week in very brief, not so brief maybe, but I tried to be as brief as I could. And we also shared the homework of collective personal reflection, if you will, on which are those things that we feel that should change in the present condition of our loving, beautiful tradition, and that can change, and that we can do something for them to change, and then take some steps to begin. that change from our own situation in a sustainable way, in a committed way in service. So I hope you got some interesting insights in this connection. And that's it. We will continue with today's topic, which again, the title is Reasons to Live and Stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava. But before going to the title itself and all that it entails, I'd like to introduce today's lecture by giving some sort of news in connection to today's topic as well, but in connection to the series, which is the idea of like a new book project in connection to this series. As many of you know, my original plan after I finished my first book, Inherent or Inherited Bhakti in the Jiva According to Gaudiya Vedanta, which was published like in March this year. When I finished it, or even before finishing it, I had in mind an idea for a second book, which was, and I announced it and I gave a series of lectures on that about Mahaprabhu and Gaur Tattva and the depths of Gaur Tattva and the possibility of Nityanavadvip. And again, as you may have seen, I gave some series of lectures this year about that. I couldn't like contain the whole content that was coming, and I tried to share that in advance. So everyone was kind of, okay, that will be the next book. I already had like 200 pages of notes. So everything was almost in place to begin with to officially write the book, even till a few weeks ago. But as we say, this is holy shift. No, there was some paradigm shift. Krishna had another plan in mind. And the zeitgeist or the need of the times requested a paradigm shift to my authorship, if you will. And the idea for a new book came to mind. So when I started this series of radical personalism, I was still with the idea of writing the book about Mahaprabhu, even when I started this series. But as the series unfolded and the ideas for the series unfolded, and there was lots of feedback and further inspiration and from different devotees and members of the Sampradaya, the series started to take a form of their own, if you will. And I remember one morning while chanting japa and trying to pray, a very clear, concrete inspiration came to write a book about this series, basically, not to like to make this series of lectures into a book, a book about radical personalism. So that was too evident for me to deny. So I put my book on Mahaprabhu to rest. No, the project is not cancelled. Hope maybe that's the third one. I hope, but at this point I cannot tell. Who knows? So then I began writing a new book with the title Radical Personalism, at least tentative title, Radical Personalism, A Revival Manifesto for Proactive Devotion. Let's see in time what happens with that. So I want to share this news to begin with you, since all of you are part of this project somehow or other, through your support, through your inspiration, even through your struggles that you are going in your daily life as a sadhaka. All that is somehow part and nourishing of this project. So I'm sharing this news, of course, not only because of the news themselves, but also because the topic of today's lecture somehow is closely tied to something I've included in the introduction of the book I'm writing. I already wrote some chapters, and I started writing the introduction to the book. And I started, but it was not working as I expected. That happens in the life of an author and in the life of any person. You try something and it doesn't work as you expected. You have days and days, cloudy days, sunny days. So I tried different ways to introduce my book, but I was still not fully satisfied with that. I mean, I've already made an introduction, but it was something telling me that's not the final, that cannot be the final version. So I was wondering for a few days now what to do, which turn to take, or how to do it. And then came a new book that I was I started to read a few weeks ago, still about to finish it, finish, quote-unquote. You can never finish a book, but a book from a Christian author called Brian McLaren, and the book is called Do I Stay Christian? With interrogation mark. Do I stay Christian? So the book came and I started reading while wondering what to do with my introduction. So interestingly, in the first two parts of that book, just checking at the table of contents, I was like, some epiphanies start to come. Because there he presents a list, an elaborate list of points to justify whether he stays a Christian or not. Well, like reasons. Why to stay, why not to stay. And then he unpacks those two lists. And then he concludes with the book with a how section. The first part is a no, why not to stay, yes, why to stay, and then how. How to stay or how even not to stay. How to continue your life in the best possible way. So he's in the last part advising how to proceed depending on the corresponding verdict, if you will. So the most interesting thing for me in connection to my wondering what to put in the introduction was that in almost every example that this author gave in his corresponding lists, somehow it was a book by a Christian author and he's speaking about Christianity. But interestingly, I felt that I could easily, when reading the list, I can easily replace the word Christian every time he mentions with the word Gaudiya Vaishnava, almost all the time, all the cases, and make that whole book applicable to my own tradition in its own way, but the core topics were very close. It's a very recommended book if you have the chance to get in it. Do I Stay Christian? By Brian McLaren. So therefore, after reading that list and finding those coincidences, God incidences, I had what I needed to resume the introduction of my book and to make my own list as why to live or to stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava, which is, again, the topic of today's lecture, reasons to live and stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava. So to begin with, I want to give this little introduction in connection to the book project and how it came to be in connection to this other book, how that other book provided this interesting idea that we will be mostly unpacking today. So of course, when I'm saying, just for you, I already clarified this at the end of the previous class, but don't get nervous, I'm not leaving Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Actually, it's not about leaving, but it's, as we will see, it's about knowing how to stay a Gaudiya Vaishnava. Because also it's not only about mere staying, but how to stay. So the list that I will share in a few moments, and also that will be included in the introduction to my future book, all this, again, do not point ultimately to leaving Gaudiya Vaishnavism. No, I'm not doing all this series of lectures and writing a book to get as much people to leave Gaudiya Vaishnavism as possible. That's not in my mind. I'm not leaving myself. Of course, one can choose whatever one wants, but the point is, this is not the idea to leave Gaudiya Vaishnavism. The idea of my series, that's not the intention. And again, the question is how to stay. Some people choose to live Gaudiya Vaishnavism in a loud way. Some people choose to live Gaudiya Vaishnavism in a silent way. Some people live to stay as Gaudiya Vaishnavism in different ways. So ultimately the question is, okay, if we want to stay, how to stay? To make the staying sustainable and also regenerative of the things that need to be healed. So the list is for those, again, this list that I will share is for those I'm not trying to kick someone out of the Sampradaya. It's for those who already belong to the Sampradaya, but also who wonder how to continue belonging. We already spoke a little bit about belonging in opposition to fitting in. So how to belong deeply to Gaudiya Sampradaya, not just to belong, not just to have official membership, card-carrying member, but heart-carrying member of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And also, it's also meant this list and today's exposition and the whole series and book. It's meant for those who have attempted to somehow belong to Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but have not yet found a community or experiences that affirm their feelings of belonging. So that's also important, how to find that or create that, if that's the case. So this series and list and book actually seek to nourish potential levers, if you will, for reasons that could actually be prevented. Of course, the idea is not to attempt to force anyone staying through unsatisfactory arguments and fear and pressure. But to be utterly honest, as I already mentioned, the main concern of this list and class and book and series is about those who still remain as fervent adherents of the tradition, of the Gaudiya tradition, but for the wrong reasons. That's concerning. Because again, it's not only about staying as a Gaudiya, but staying for the right reasons. But some people stay as a Gaudiya for the wrong reasons. And that creates a sort of disjointed membership. And that makes of the tradition something more and more disparate from it was supposed to be. More and more distorted from all that it can be. And such wrong membership, if you will, is basically a misrepresentation of the lineage. And sometimes that distorted or misrepresentation is overly justified with the most antithetical reasoning that we could imagine. And again, all of that in the name of belonging. And of course, all of us are one of those, at least potentially. Although we may not identify with that prospect, potential is there, so we should be humble and careful and properly informed about what not to do. So again, we want everyone to stay in their own respective traditions. We are not here wanting people to leave their tradition, but we want them to stay there only for the right reasons, not for the wrong reasons. That's actual substantial belonging. Whatever goes against this principle of substantial belonging can be at best regarded as fitting in. But again, that's not the same as deep belonging. That's what we are about as radical personalists and as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, which again, remember, every time we say radical personalism, it's another way of saying Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So, interestingly, in this connection, people leaving or staying for right or wrong reasons, I would dare to say that the reasons some people at least leave Gaudiya Vaishnavism are healthier than the reasons for which some people stay as Gaudiya Vaishnavas. And why I'm saying this, to give an example, of course there are many possibilities, but for example, the reasons that these two groups have may be exactly the same. In other words, someone may stay and leave exactly for the same reasons, but from different places. No? One same situation may prompt one to desist, another may prompt one to persist. To give an example, like a sincere seeker may feel the need to take a distance from Gaudiya Vaishnavism due to having witnessed excessive conformity to the statu quo for the sake of position and prestige in a level that is overwhelming. So he chose, I need a distance from this. And another person may choose to stay exactly because of that. Because of statu quo, position, prestige, all these perks that the person may feel, I'm being benefited from Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Srila Prabhupada says some people come to serve in Krishna consciousness and other comes to be served from. There are different, again, reasons why some people stay, reasons why some people leave. So again, for this reason, this series are not only exploring potential causes for leaving one's tradition, but we are also trying to understand on another level why some members have chosen to continue their journey in this particular school despite everything, despite so many things, why they stay, not only why they are leaving, but also those who stay, why they are staying, wrong reasons, right reasons, and those who choose to stay, how we can make that choice of staying, how can that choice be informed in such a way that those who stay continue staying for the right reasons. Again, because you can begin staying for the right reasons, but at some point you can shift and continue to stay for the wrong reasons. And again, someone can live for the wrong reasons, someone can live for the right. There are so many possibilities. So almost there to the, in the list. So Gaudiya Vaishnavism, as you may know, is very, it's a complex array of diverse elements. Now, it's not just one thing that we can reduce to one specific unique feature or something like that. So since Gaudiya Vaishnavism, as any other mystical tradition, is a very intricate arrangement and so many layers and elements, the reasons for someone staying or living in that tradition may be also closely tied to one or more of all of these manifold layers and aspects. Which, of course, here I don't have the time to address all of them in detail and all the time it requires, but there are so many of them. Cultural aspects, theological, institutional, historical, political, doctrinal, social, among many others. So the reasons to live or stay may be closely tied to any of these or combination of these or some or many others. And in my personal case, of course, I've been deeply associated with each of these features for more than 2 decades by now. So I will then share, after saying this, and after considering my own experience, I'd like to share with you a quick list of reasons that I made while, again, rewriting the introduction to my for next book, reasons to stay and not to stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava. Of course, some of the things I will mention, especially the no's, may be more related to one particular group, one particular tradition and others. But also beyond this, it's also related to levels of consciousness and to ways of human psychology that can happen in any of us. Like I remember when we gave a series of lectures on apasampradayas, and I remember we make the point over and over again, okay, we have this apasampradaya, but actually this apasampradaya can be in our own minds. Of these deviated principles, distorted ways of conceiving things. It's not about pointing to some outer enemy, but it all begins at home. So anyhow, I will share this list that I wrote as part of the introduction to my new book. And it's a list upon which, of course, the whole book will unfold somehow on the basis of that particular list. It will include 10 no's and 10 yes after. 10 first why not to stay, then why to stay. And the rest of today's lecture will be basically a brief unpacking of each of these points, which will be 10 and 10, 20 in total, briefly. In the book, there will be a more comprehensive unfolding of it. So I will first read all of them one after another without any explanation, and then we will go one by one, briefly, but on some level. So let's begin with reasons why not to stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava. So now we come officially to the section that gives a name to today's class, reasons to live and stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava. So let's start with the no's. Like sometimes when someone asks you, I don't know if you say that in English, like, I have two news to give you, one bad and one good. Which one you prefer first? The bad. So let's begin with the no's. To properly balance the yes, that's the idea. Again, not to be overtly critical or so on, but just to sober our yes and not make just an immature yes, if you will. So the 10 ones I mentioned says like this. First, lack of human sensibility and psychological balance. Two, tribal thinking or sectarian thinking and poor capacity for dynamic dialogue. Three, unaddressed abuses of different types. Four, deep cognitive rigidity and various types of fundamentalism. Five, not enough appreciation for other mystical schools. Six, not enough appreciation for other forms of non-mystical knowledge. Seven, chauvinism, institutional patriarchy, and other forms of discrimination. Eight, theological elitism and esoteric aristocracy. I will explain them. 9. Toxic nostalgia toward past achievements and unwillingness to deal with the modern world's paradigms. And 10. Over-idealized emphasis on proselytism. So those are the first 10 no's. Now comes the 10 yes. Why to stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava? Why still I'm here despite all the above? So the first one is because the above 10 reasons for not staying are not part of the actual Gaudiya doctrine, but rather the result of an immature understanding and application of it. In other words, it has nothing to do with being a Gaudiya Vaishnava, but it's there. 2. Why to stay? Patience, gratitude, and compassion rule the day despite all. 3. A noble ideal and lifestyle will nourish and accompany our progress. Again, if we stay. 4. A unique level of theological depth, an intricate description of post-liberated life. 5. The undeniable presence of both past and present saints who embody the essence of the tradition. 6. The sweetness and relating to the Lord through the chanting of His holy name. 7. Dedicated contribution of wonderful souls who are truly in love with the Gaudiya ideal. 8. The maintenance of sacred pilgrimage sites around the world that give shelter and hope to many. 9. The life, legacy, and gift of Sri Gaudhari, the founder and deity of the Gaudiya school. And 10. Holy and deep personal commitment experienced in the company of authentic kindred spirits. Again, of course, so many other things to say. I don't have just 10 nice things to say about Gaudiya Sampradaya, nor either 10 things to, not so nice things to say. But anyhow, that's something, at least, that's my list. And that's something that I wrote quickly and is part of my introduction. Probably in time I may adjust some details. But whatever the case, for whatever it's worth, that's my list, which is offering the spirit of service and shared reflection. Collective introspection, Sankirtan. And of course, if you feel so inclined, you are also invited to write your own and share it with all these days in the threads or privately or even for yourself. That will be today's homework, basically. Now you write your own list as to give your own belonging to the Sampradaya a sobering and balanced and realistic appreciation of whatever may be happening in all directions. So, needless to say, and before going to the unpacking on each one of the points, most of the above no's, which were in the first list, are not limited to the Gaudiya tradition, as you may have seen. Indeed, do not belong to the essence of the tradition, but whatever happens to be there also are present in other traditions, not even in other traditions only. But all these issues that I mentioned in the first list basically depict, I could say, the present condition and psychology of most of the human race, to be realistic and empathic and compassionate also, because most of the human race is not yet properly enlightened, properly integrated as wholesome beings, so naturally those symptoms will come. And despite that, I embrace those no's in the mood of acknowledgement and also in the context of then later embracing the yes. Since I personally, again, choose to stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava, despite the no's. All those no's merely for me portray the type of practitioner I don't want to be. So I can learn from those as well. As we have gurus who teach us what to do and people who teach us what not to do, in that sense, they are our gurus, like Indra in the Bhagavatam so many times. So in that same way, all these lists of no's, which are basically a byproduct of immature understanding, and which I'm not free from them, so that's a point. When I'm pointing at those 10 things, it's not about someone else doing that, also maybe, but let's begin at home. So those things portray what I don't want to be. I may still be, but I don't want to be. So my potential goes in another direction. So in this way, the above two lists are not about whether we stay as Gaudiyas or not, but mostly I would say is how to stay as humans as we can while we remain as Gaudiyas. Because it's about remaining Gaudiyas, but how we remain also properly human, which has a lot to do with the first list, I would say. So anyhow, that's it. Let's briefly unpack the above two lists. Only briefly, again, as you may imagine, each one of those points requires separate, not only lecture, but a separate book. So, briefly, because somehow the rest of the series, as well as the book I'm planning to write, all that will try somehow to unfold the implications of these lists. And also because, of course, we need to unpack those implications ourselves in our daily life according to how they relate to us, some more, some less. We have our own list, our personal experience. So we have also to remain personal and understand all this through our individual personal situation. Because remember, above all, this is all about remaining personal. Radical personalism, don't forget. So anyhow, so let's go to the next section after presenting the reasons to leave and stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava. And now we will unpack list first, and then the second one. I may take a little bit more time with this first one. So let's unpack the reasons for not staying as a Gaudiya Vaishnava. So let's go one by one. The first of the list was lack of human sensibility and psychological balance. So I made it clear again, this is not part of the original teaching of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, but that's something that is clearly appreciated in a big part of the representatives of the Sampradaya. And again, I'm not saying every one of them at all, but at times, a sign of the times that we need to address, at least personally, I consider that. So lack of human sensibility and psychological balance. As I mentioned in our previous class, I feel that we not only need to appreciate the contributions of psychology, for example, but we do need to do family therapy as well, as a family, and heal unaddressed wounds and acknowledge hidden unresolved trauma from the past, as a school, if you will. It all begins from the individual, of course, but it eventually extends to the family circle. So, of course, when I'm saying the need for psychological balance, I don't also want to go to the extreme of overemphasizing psychology to the point that it becomes more important than the transcendental practice itself. I'm not saying this. I'm not saying that psychology is above the mercy of Bhagavan or something to that effect. Interestingly, I would say that the ultimate solution to most of psychological problems is always spiritual. But psychology, again, it can be useful, as we mentioned today. It's not to go to the other extreme of underestimating it and describing it as Maya or as something completely non-transcendental and useless, and overemphasizing the esoteric side of our tradition while we need to embrace psychology on some level. So again, all the things are okay. No? Esoteric content is okay. Psychological balance is okay. So we are not demonizing anything, but the proportions sometimes are the problem. Sometimes we are underestimating something and overestimating something, relativizing something and over-absolutizing something. So everything has to be in its right place according, again, to the need of each individual. Both esoteric content as well as psychological balance. And another way to speak about psychic balance in our tradition, the word that comes to mind is sattva. Sattva basically means to be a wholesome, integrated human being, to be properly established in our physical, psychic, emotional dimensions, and of course properly paying attention to our particular acquired nature, vocations, and being harmonized, aligned with that. So that will be a very crucial foundation for our Visuddha Sattva project, if you will. Visuddha Sattva means transcendence. So first you need Sattva, to lay the foundation so the plane of Visuddha Sattva can leave. But first you have to get to the airport of Sattva, if you will. Because if we don't have that, and if we bypass or skip proper psychological balance and human sensibilities, in the name of transcendence, we can end up exhibiting all sorts of dysfunctionalities. And even we can have senior members in our communities, even elders or so-called elders, or sometimes even gurus, with unresolved trauma from the past, or with lots of repressed unconscious issues. And sometimes we have people with those same problems worshipping them, the other people with those same problems, but having certain expectations that are not going to happen, because first we need to solve some of these issues. And why this happens sometimes, because also with this I'm not blaming elders or gurus, because we ourselves, wherever we may be, have a responsibility in dealing with that. And sometimes we also expect everything to be perfect and over-idealize. So we expect everything to be perfect and not to be human. And we have to embrace humanity first, instead of demanding perfection and transcendence. We have to embrace humanity with all its brokenness and woundedness and imperfection, and allowing that to happen in a proper way, of course, not this as an excuse for degradation or anything. And then we can have a more realistic, sober notion of transcendence, especially our notion of transcendence, where Krishna is this wrapped and dressed in divine imperfection, if you will. So humanity is crucial here. We want to enter human relationships with all that they entail, and they entail a lot, are crucial. They matter now and in transcendence, not only in one of the two, in both of them. Because we say, yeah, human lila, nara lila, we want to enter the nara lila of Braj. It's human-like. Yes, but for entering that dimension of humanity expressed in the context of divine life, first we need to know what to do with our humanity here and now. So human relationships are very important now, as well as in transcendence. You know? It's interesting that humanity remains in transcendence, of course, in a very unique form, but still there's that element of humanity. So it's something to consider, to give proper importance here and now, not only when we get there. I mean, we won't get there if we don't give proper importance to that here and now. So we have to integrate our humanity with all that it entails. Again, embracing our frailty, imperfection, needs, in the context of bhakti. And that will be glorious. That's not embarrassing. That's not a cause for shame and guilt and all these fear trips that sometimes our ego goes. So we need to embrace humanity, not reject humanity. Because if not, our transcendence will make us inhuman. And our transcendence includes the notion of human. It's nara lila. It's not anara lila. It's not inhuman lila. It's human-like lila. Because if not, in the name of transcendence, our heart becomes a stone and we end up being inhuman. So we need to learn how to relate to each other, to God, without the need of guilt, shame, fear, but trust, openness, love, and so on. So as we mentioned before, before transcending, and even before ascending, we need descending. We need grounding. We need to ground ourselves as humans and properly develop or horizontally before we can develop ourselves vertically, before the quantum leap into the Nara Lila. Because if we do not do this positive work as humans, transcendence ends up being a negative project, an issue of that is limited to rejecting all that is bad, a neti neti school. This is not, this is Maya, that is Maya, the world is Maya, this is bad. The world is bad, Maya is bad, other people who is not Gaudiya is bad, be careful, watch out, our body is bad. Rejecting and rejecting instead of embracing and integrating. I always recall a very nice book written by a Gaudiya some decades ago called Unspoken Obstacles in the Path of Bhakti by Purnachandra Swami. At that time he was Purnachandra Das, I think. That's very recommended for those who, like, we made a series of lectures years ago. He addresses many of these issues. So we have to be very careful. We have such a positive tradition, such a positive content. Watch out not to make it too negative. Too much emphasis on tyag, on renunciation, on mukti, or getting out from this world. Getting out from samsara, world denial. Not that, not this. As I recently, one friend of mine shared with me in history, she's someone from the old times, the old school of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. I mean, she's not old school in mentality, but she went through very interesting experiences, and one of them was she was riding on a bus like 50 years ago with other groups of devotees, Prabhupada disciples, and the driver of the bus told him, "You have to sit on the floor. You cannot walk because you cannot watch outside of the window because that's Maya. No, you cannot watch outside of the window. So in order for that not to happen, sit down in the floor. Between one seat on the other in the floor, there's not too much space." So that was the methodology to transcend the world, basically. I hope you feel that that's not very integrated and mature. So, of course, this may sound as an extreme example, but there are so many varieties of that keep with this principle of transcending is denying, transcending is rejecting, transcending is not about integrating and accepting humanly. And that's what transcending is about, again. Transcending is, includes humanity. It's not about becoming more and more inhuman. Or, of course, just to conclude this first point, because I may be tempted to go the whole lecture only with this one, regarding lack of human sensibility and psychological balance, sometimes also we end up overjudging devotees for having some moral lapse. I don't know, someone broke some of the four regulative principles, and that's hell for some of us. Oh, you are no longer a devotee. That's catastrophe, apocalypse. Well, there are so many things that are much worse than that, I can tell you. Or even condemning the breaking of those principles without ourselves properly understanding what those principles are about. Like when I spoke with Navras in our last podcast on social media, and the fifth regulative principle being how to relate to social media properly, that should be made a whole fifth principle. But even the four principles are not generally understood very nicely, very deeply. We generally think, okay, not meat eating, first principle. And it's not about not meat eating. Okay, it's about being vegetarian. No, it's not about being vegetarian. Vegan. Not about being vegan. Okay, being non-violent, ahimsa, that's what it's about. Yes, but try to go deeper, as Mahaprabhu will say to Ramananda Roy, "Eko bahya, eko agahar." No, that's superficial. Go deeper. So it's not even about being non-violent. It's about being loving, which is the positive side of non-violent. And not only about being loving and compassionate, but being as loving as compassionate as you can be. So there you have a more fully blossomed notion of something that began with "Do not eat meat." So that single point is actually pointing to a broader conception of that particular principle, and the same applies to all of the other principles. So we need to understand all these things in a more dynamic way and relate to others in that more dynamic and deep way. And similarly, in this connection of not being enough humanly enough or properly balanced to deal psychologically some issues, I will say that as part of this in Gaudiya Sampradaya, still there is lots of, we are promoting shame-based sexual understandings also through purity culture, basically. And even as we were speaking with Swan about this day, we have a deep case of erotophobia, or fear of sex, even. I remember we spoke some months ago about one class called Can Sex Be Bhakti? So it's at least it's important whether we may agree or not with all or how everyone addresses these points. We need to speak about those things. We need to go deeper. Or how we adjust monastic life, monasticism, how we deal with sannyas ashram and certain situations that have come recently or not even recently, or how to frame renunciation and not to abuse terms like yukta vairagya, in the name of using everything in the service of Krishna, we may be compromising our ideals and so on. Anyhow, that requires lots of unfolding, and we will try to do in the next classes and in the forthcoming book and so on. Let's go to the next point, the second point. Tribal thinking, and by tribal I'm not criticizing the notion of tribe, which means a group of like-minded people, but tribal, in this case I'm using the word in a negative connotation by implying sectarian, which also is a word that it's not necessarily negative, but here we are employing that context. Tribal thinking and poor capacity for dynamic dialogue. So, again, most of the practitioners of a particular group probably are in an infant-like level of consciousness, and it's okay. Again, we are not condemning that. It's how everything begins, from something more simplistic to something more complex and elaborate. So in the beginning, we will measure reality in a very particular way and trying to label everything, as we already spoke about boxes and so on. And we end up labeling everything and everyone in pretty much sectarian terms in the beginning of our first stages of development in consciousness, through tribe narratives. Again, tribe used in negative context. Like only our group, only this particular view, and so on. Which is, again, it has its place, but in certain stages it becomes unbecoming. And, of course, the opposite to that is deep belonging, not only a formal sense of belonging. So gradually we need to overcome these biases. And we need to take care that our general presentation of the teaching is not promoting those biases, and that we have deep elders which are deeply concerned about working on that in themselves and others, and create a clear developmental prospect for this to happen. So in connection to these, different biases that generally keep us in the tribal thinking level and poor capacity for dialogue, even to dialogue with ourselves, I'd like to share a series of biases that I shared a few days ago on social media. Some of you may have read them, but I will mention them briefly because they are very interesting into how they depict what we don't want to be, basically, again. So the first one is confirmation bias. Confirmation bias names our brain's tendency to reject anything that doesn't fit in with our current understanding, paradigm, belief system, or worldview. It's closely related to about a dozen other biases, including. So now comes a fleshing out of this original confirmation bias. Complexity bias, our brain's tendency to prefer a simple lie to a complex truth. So we want simplistic, which is not the same as simple, actually, properly integrated. But if truth is complex, we want things to be simple, even if in the process of that, truth has gone, truth disappears. Community bias. Our brain's tendency to reject any idea that will endanger our status in communities we belong to, and to choose tribe over truth. Again, tribe in the sense of status quo, in this case. So whatever puts in danger my position, I have already mechanism to protect that. Comfort complacency bias. Our brain's tendency to reject information that makes us uncomfortable, is inconvenient, or disrupts our complacency. Sometimes this is called also cognitive dissonance. Whatever doesn't fit my paradigm and throws me into an ocean of unknown, outside of the comfort zone, generally we tend to protect from that or attack that even. Then confidence bias. Our brain's tendency to believe people who display confidence. If someone is confident, we immediately think, oh, he must be right. Rendering us susceptible to those who come on strong, even when they are wrong, including authoritarians and con artists. So sometimes we have that particular bias. And whenever someone feels very sure of himself, convinced, and is even charismatic or confident, we just accept, okay, he must be true. And that can end up in dictatorship, if you will, other types of exploitation. Conspiracy bias. Our brain's tendency to believe stories that exonerate us or portray us as innocent victims or unsung heroes while vilifying an outgroup or individual, real or concocted. So this is a very subtle one. Because externally you may be like, how to say, criticizing something that is worthy of being criticized, but you are doing from the wrong place. This may be a case, of course. We may be doing this exercise. We run the risk of talking all the things we are talking from a conspiracy bias. So we should be very prayerful and careful and humble to do all the things from the proper place in our heart. Because again, you can point at some abuse. You can identify with the abused victims, but only as a way of, through that identification with the abuse, as an attempt of transferring their innocence toward you. It's a very subtle type of exchange. Someone is abused and I identify with the victim, but just as a way of transferring their innocence to you. And I'm also innocent. A cult of innocence, I'm called. Let's go to two more. Catastrophe or normalcy bias. Our brain's tendency to respond to dramatic catastrophes, but easily miss compounding slow erosions of normalcy. In other words, if something very 9/11 happens, we will respond to that. But our daily 9/11s, if you will, we won't do anything about that. Because there are slow erosions of normalcy. They became normal to our daily life. Well, they need to be addressed as well. And last one, cache bias. Our brain's tendency to accept information that might interfere with our way of making a living. So somehow connected with the one about status quo and position. So these and other biases, of course, prevent us, going back to the initial premise of this line, tribal thinking and poor capacity for dynamic dialogue. These and other biases prevents us from having meaningful dialogues with ourselves, and openness to truth, and deep relationship with each other, because we will be framing and calculating everything according to convenience and comfort zone. And we will remain more on a superficial level of prejudice and labeling, which again is another form of tribal thinking. And I think, again, yes, Gaudiya Sampradaya has lots to work on this. Again, it's not Gaudiya Sampradaya alone. Every religious tradition for sure, and most of humanity, including ourselves. But here we are framing the discussion in this particular direction. And we're trying to commit to that as part of the school. Let's go to the third one. Bear with me a few minutes, please. The third one is unaddressed abuse of different types. Long topics. And contemporary one, as you may know. So I may begin here, of course, with abuses such as child abuse, in this form of violence, in the form of sexual abuse, of course, underage people, boys, girls abused. But again, not only of sexual type, but including physical violence, including psychic violence, emotional violence, manipulation, indoctrination, imposition of sorts, and so many nuances and layers inside of that. But also, I will not limit, of course, the idea of abuse to woman or to child or to children, but we can also extend the pattern to adult abuse, where adult people is abused in the form of defamation, ostracizing, shunning, character assassination, so many things, all of which can be equally traumatic forms of abuse in some cases. So needless to say, of course, all of these abuses are in themselves pathetic. The hiding, the covering, and the denial of them is what makes this particular point of the list even more concerning. Unaddressed abuse of different types. Of course, the abuse in itself, again, is something we don't want. But how we deal with those abuses that we know are there. And what to say when those things are supported, sponsored, hidden, covered, anyhow, denied. So again, these issues need to be exposed. These issues need to be addressed. Not only, again, the abuse, but the covering up of them, dismissing of them. These issues need to be properly dealt with. Again, not in the spirit of revenge. No, we are not here calling for a violent revolution or anything like that. Not in the spirit of revenge, nor hateful chastisement, like I would like that people to burn in hell forever and to suffer as much as I would like. No, not in that sense. Or also not to fall into victim consciousness, or as I mentioned, to innocent cult. No, I identify so much with the victims that I transfer their innocence to them, to me. But this is about all these things are mentioned in the context of education. This is an education, even like karma. Karma is an educational law. It's not about chastisement. It's about reformation of each of the parts involved, so they can become functional members of the life and society again. And that being done from a empathic, compassionate spirit, which of course properly discerns and properly ascertains the necessary procedures for each particular case. Again, I'm here just speaking in a very general way. Each of us need to know what to do in each particular situation. But so some words about unaddressed abuse of different types, which I personally, of course, believe also that's the case in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. That's an important one. Next one. Deep cognitive rigidity and various types of fundamentalism. This is somehow similar to the second one, but there are some slight variations. So let me unfold briefly. So for example, for me, at least in this connection, cognitive rigidity or fundamentalism even has to do with what sometimes I like to call overdose of certainty. Overdose of certainty. Like you have too much certainty. You are too sure about everything. You know everything, how to reply to every question. We have perfect answers to everything. Always we are not able to say, I don't know. We are not willing to acknowledge that we don't know many things. We are not even to acknowledge that the things that we don't know are more than the things that we know. Or we have this idea, like we should show ourselves as perfect and all-knowing. If you are a representative, a guru, a sannyasi, or whatever, a devotee to the world, how you have to show. And again, this overdose of certainty is another way of saying, actually, we have a deep inability to deal with uncertainty, to deal with paradox, to deal with mystery, darkness, unknowing, all these realms that lie outside of the comfort zone. And we need to embrace those layers as well. Our tradition points to that, actually. Our tradition is very dynamic, so we need to represent it, as we mentioned, living school of living prophets. So we need to represent it accordingly. But nowadays, again, many of these things have become formulaic, mechanistic, and boring. So we need to have more, not only critical thinking, but again, willingness to integrate our shadow if we want to continue talking in terms of the last class. No? Feeling okay while coexisting with uncertainty, and not feeling the need to have always the right answers to everything. Because of course we have a very refined, deep, revealed knowledge, but that doesn't mean that we have full realization of that we cannot learn from any other place and so on. Or sometimes, again, this cognitive rigidity or fundamentalism can express itself in the form of authorities imposing a set of dogmas that, if they are not followed, they create some form of fear or terror in the so-called heretics. No? This is the way of doing. If not, you are an aparadi. If you do that, you are out of the loop, if you will, of the grace loop. So it's an excess, an overdose of order. Everything has to be ordered and in place. When you have too much order and do not allow some chaos to balance the equation, you get closer and closer to a totalitarian regime, basically. So yes, of course, we may say, but we Gaudiyas do not have, as Christians did, crusades or inquisition per se. Yeah, we don't have those till now per se, but we may have our own version of them in different ways. Again, by shunning, ostracizing, condemning, and labeling people. Like I remember when I when I wrote my first book, when I spoke about whether bhakti is inherent or not in the jiva and tried to explain why some of our contemporary acharyas seem to say otherwise in relation to Jiva Goswami and Shastra, and there were some strong reactions. I won't call them inquisitional, but I was basically labeled as an enemy of the Sampradaya and a few other boxes that I was thrown in. So yeah, we need to, I will say, we need to mature a little bit more, and we need to think outside of the box and be open to some other possibilities and dialogue about them. Let's go to the next point. Not enough appreciation for other mystical schools. So again, this goes beyond not appreciating other opinions inside the same school. Now we go to other mystical schools, which is, of course, when I say this, I'm not saying let's organize more interfaith dialogues and that's it. But let's dialogue with other traditions in the way that it nourishes the dialogue with our own tradition, from interfaith dialogue to intra-faith dialogue. Because in order to talk to other traditions, you have to be very well acquainted with your own tradition and to have deep dialogue with yourself as a member of your tradition. So when you hear someone else, you can appreciate different expressions of your own tradition there. You can learn from them and you can return to your own tradition. How to nourish my own tradition through other traditions? That's possible. How not to see them as a competition, but as a complement. we should be very... Of course, we choose a particular tradition and it's the best for us, and we are convinced of that. That's why we are here. But we should be very careful not to think my tradition is the complete version of reality and all of the others are perverted reflections or partial versions of my tradition. I don't think, although in the beginning one may like to think like that, we might need to think like that, at some point we may need to not think like that and to appreciate each tradition for what it is. And, and as Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, you know, I'm entering to a mosque or a church and I wonder, wow, how incredible, how they are worshipping my Krishna here. And okay, no, there is inspiration and charm by appreciating that. Because if not, we may fall into what we call over-identification with my own tradition. Again, we can go deeper and deeper into our own tradition that has no limit, but there's a way of over-identifying with the tradition to the point of not being able to appreciate anything beyond itself, or to the point of not seeing our tradition in other traditions, not drawing any nourishing from other wisdom traditions. So that's the challenge, you know, how to draw nourishing from other wisdom traditions and from there go back and rediscover my own tradition by what I receive from other people. There's a possibility in that. Because if not, if we only over-identify with our own tradition, we'll be very afraid to watch beyond that particular wall, and we will be very quick to label, quick to judge, and quick to hide ourselves in our own dogma, if you will. So again, sorry for being so brief, which is at this point, which deserves so much unfolding, and we will try to do so in the rest of the series. The next point, we have a few more, is not enough appreciation for other forms of non-mystical knowledge. So it's not only about not appreciating other opinions in my tradition, it's not about not appreciating other mystical traditions, but other secular disciplines, if you will, other forms of non-mystical knowledge. As we mentioned, we should be ready to embrace other disciplines like psychology, history, sociology, and science, among others, and nourish the understanding of scripture and of our own tradition through them. They're very interesting areas of knowledge. And many of them are teaching so many things. Now, for example, science comes to mind. And I would say that the genius of science, the heart and essence of science, or the scientific method, and with this I'm not saying praising science about divine revelation and point to some specific point. And the scientific method is a method that by which it can, and in fact, it must amend its facts, if you will. In other words, scientific method is we are always open for new learning. We never get to a conclusive point that there's nothing further to be known, but it is constant. Okay, experiment, and whatever we thought is true was true, we now realize there is a further truth to that. We are willing to change and to grow. We should learn from that. Because that method helps one to align, to attain greater and greater levels of alignment with reality. As flaw as that may be in connection to understand transcendence, of course, I know its limits on the empirical level, but the essence of that is very important. How I can attain greater and greater alignment with reality. Next point. And I will be briefer and briefer because we are getting already too long already. Chauvinism, institutional patriarchy, and other forms of discrimination. Somehow different points are connected to one another, I know. So something in this connection, for example, to chauvinism, women. Women in Gaudiya Vaishnavism generally are not yet very well appreciated as they deserve, if you will. Women don't need a separate set of rules than men, for example. Other gender designations do not need a separate set of rules apart from men. Everyone else, apart from the Gaudiya men, do not need a separate set of rules from the Gaudiya men. You follow my point? If you're a woman, if you're homosexual, whatever designation, but if you have the adhikar for bhakti, or the adhikar for whatever it has to be, eligibility, you can engage in any of those functions. Pujari, guru. I mean, still there are some groups where if you are a woman, you cannot be a guru because you are a woman. That's like very basic misunderstanding, very primitive one. I mean, you will be a guru. Of course, it's not that because we need more woman gurus. We need gurus who are qualified, whether they are woman or not, or men. That's the point. Whatever the designation, if they are qualified, that's the important thing. And it's interesting because Gaudiya Vaishnavism is quite a female-oriented tradition with lots of emphasis on the principle of Shakti, lots of influence from different tantras, scriptures, and so on. But at the same time, Gaudiya Vaishnavism has exhibited throughout history a good amount of what I would call toxic masculinity in many ways. Like lots of overemphasis and excessive masculine attitudes, but to the excess, not to the point of being faulty. Not only overemphasizing men above ladies on social layers and so on, but also excessing in masculine qualities to the point of toxicity, not like typical male qualities like authority or search for honor and worship. All those are classically male qualities, which I'm not condemning there, but they can be in excess. And we are seeing this, and this needs to be addressed as well. The context, again, of institutional patriarchy and other forms of discrimination. Next point. Theological elitism and esoteric aristocracy. So what do I mean by this? Well, we have such a refined philosophy, as I mentioned already, that we can easily fall prey into the trap of not only consider ourselves like better than others, we know so much, this information is anywhere else, but also we may use high esoteric concepts to hide unresolved lower issues, as I already mentioned. So we create an elite of theologians or an aristocracy of esotericism, but all that may be used to, again, not address urgent issues that need to be required. And instead we may create an hyper elite oligarchy or something in which the apparent qualified ones are allowed to enter or speak about, or everyone is forced to go there as that's the highest thing, you should be there. And actually we are remaining in a theological comfort zone, if you will, speaking about high topics from the comfort zone without going out of the comfort zone, and probably developing some superiority complex also in relation to other traditions and in relation to those who do not speak the topics we talk about, but we ourselves need still to solve so many other things. So that's also something that requires some addressing, I would say. Penultimate point is toxic nostalgia toward past achievements and an unwillingness to deal with the modern world's paradigms. Again, I'm not saying this in absolute terms and everyone in the Gaudiya Sampradaya is in that situation, but we are speaking in overall terms. So, yeah, sometimes there is this toxic nostalgia where we like to speak about what our past acharyas did and how glorious that was, and it was, and it is. But for that to be even more glorious, we need to do something else in the present, as we already spoke. Because the past always seems better from the present's perspective. More glorious is the past than the present, but Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say something similar. We have the tendency to glorify the past acharyas and not so much the present ones, or not so much appreciate what we have to do in the present. And we take rest in the past. And again, the past has been glorious, and we need to honor it, but especially, we already spoke about this, we need to honor it by doing today what our glorious ancestors will be doing themselves now. That's parampara, that's the spirit of a living tradition. What will Srila Prabhupada say today, now? So we are rooted in tradition, no? We are rooted in the past, so we know what to do in the present, but we are not abusing, misusing the past as an excuse to avoid the present. That will be to be rotten in tradition, not to be rooted in tradition. So we have to be rooted in tradition, not rotten in tradition. And of course, regarding the past, then we have the present, and the present, we are in the postmodern world, quite complex, quite particular paradigms, and this postmodern world presents its own set of challenges and dynamics that need to be addressed in a realistic way, not only in terms of how we adjust our language to preach to the people, but we are members of that world dynamic, so how we engage with the world in a realistic way, even by resorting to new ways of framing and dealing with contemporary issues that have not been mentioned in Shastra, for example, like ecological crisis or nuclear catastrophe, gender issues, abortion, how we relate with social media in a healthy way, how even we use our own Gaudiya glossary, how much our Gaudiya glossary requires an update and upgrade, not to change the terms, but now how to understand them properly with our present day paradigms, with the words we use, how we think, and so on. Anyhow, the last point of the list, of the no's list, I didn't touch upon the yes list yet. So the last point of the no's list is over-idealized emphasis on proselytism. So with this I mean, sometimes we push too much into conquering others, transforming others, but we are not here to save the world. First, you have to save yourself, which is way more difficult, I can tell you. And of course, sometimes we may try to save the world so we don't have to do the necessary individual work to save ourselves. And sometimes, in the name of trying to save others or help others, sometimes, not always, our emphasis or overemphasis on proselytism is hiding other things as well. For example, sometimes you want the whole world to be chanting Hare Krishna, not because of universal compassion, but because you are not convinced yourself so much about your own chanting of Hare Krishna. So you need the whole world doing that, so you are convinced, okay, I am in the right place here, because everyone else is doing this. So I must be doing it. Whatever I'm doing must be right. You follow? So sometimes we may think, no, I want to preach and help others, universal compassion, but actually it's more a way of seeing everyone else doing bhakti, since I myself am not that convinced of it. So it has more to do with my weak faith. And remember, as we already spoke, the movement grows as your heart expands. It's not the need to have every single entity in the planet do what you are doing. The movement will grow and expand as your heart expands. And that quality of heart expansion will bring whatever necessary quantity has to be there. So the Prabhupada said, let's boil the milk now also. So anyhow, some words in trying to unpack and unfold the first list. still have the whole second list, and don't be afraid I won't take the same time to go through that. That'd be me too much. The second list, as you know, is unpacking the reasons for staying as a Gaudiya Vaishnava. So I won't unpack them with the same level of detail. In one sense, I've done that through the last 20 years in all my lectures. But I will mention, of course, I will mention the 10 points of the list of yes to properly balance what we have mentioned now. But since we don't have that much time left, we will continue, of course, unpacking them throughout the rest of the series and the forthcoming book as well. So I'll just mention them and maybe mention a brief word, but just very quickly. So it says like this. Of course, the first reason to, despite the 10 no's, the first reason to remain as a Gaudiya is because the above 10 reasons for not staying, again, are not part of the actual Gaudiya doctrine, but rather the result of an immature understanding and application of it. So it's always very important to separate one thing and the other. Of course, we need to see mature practitioners that show us, okay, the doctrine is something separate. Yeah, but I need someone embodying that doctrine as well. Because if you tell me the doctrine is perfect, but the practitioners are all imperfect, that we may not be able to embrace the doctrine. So, of course, there are proper practitioners that will embody what the doctrine is about. And that's our shelter for sure. And the doctrine itself, we know the Gaudiya teaching is not about these things in essence. It's just about the misunderstanding of that, and we should deal that with compassion and empathy. That's the second point. Patience, gratitude, and compassion rule the day, despite all. In other words, despite all that may be happening, despite all the no's, we should learn to be patient, grateful for all that we are receiving, and compassionate for the mistakes that we ourselves first commit. And at the end of the day, that will rule the day. That will make the most substantial change of all. Third, a noble ideal and lifestyle will nourish and accompany our progress. So again, despite all the problems that we may have as a school, still the ideal is totally noble. The lifestyle is unparalleled. So if we continue practicing despite all, that will nourish and accompany our progress. While considering the no's, while being realistic and sober about that. The next one, four, a unique level of theological depth and intricate description of post-liberated life. You know, how our tradition describes in detail the life in Leela and the charm of Krishna Leela, Gaur Leela, and the unique theological depth. That's incredible. That in itself is charming enough to struggle all that we need to struggle to continue as Gaudiyas in the best possible way. The next one, five, is the undeniable presence of both past and present saints who embody the essence of the tradition. Which is, again, this is something that is not only regarding the past, but in the present, we also have those personalities who remind us this is not just a dead language, a dead teaching, a museum piece, but something alive. Sixth, the sweetness of relating to the Lord through the chanting of His holy name. Of course, the chanting of Harinam, Sankirtan, Japa, relating to Bhagavan personally, in his most personal way as his name. That's something that has no parallel. How the Gaudiyas have developed this idea of non-difference between the name and the named. That's another enough reason to stay and to try to solve on the nose, if you will. Seven, dedicated contribution of wonderful souls who are truly in love with the Gaudiya ideal. So also we can be beyond another way of speaking of present-day saints, but many sincere devotees of different levels and situations who are really sincerely contributing with incredible things by their own love with the Gaudiya ideal and prospect. Eight, the maintenance of sacred pilgrimage sites around the world that give shelter and hope to many. So again, this is an extension of the previous one. Not only by this I refer to places in India or Dham or the Dham, but different temples and ashrams and houses and spots which are kept and developed so people have hope and shelter and inspiration. That's in itself another glorious reason to continue. Nine, the life, legacy and gift of Sri Gaur Hari, the founder and deity of the Gaudiya school. So again, Sriman Mahaprabhu and his life story if you will, and the concept of Mahaprabhu himself, the depth of Gaur Tattva, the result of that, the reach of his gift, all the things are really without parallel. I wish our hearts should be moved to tears while contemplating that, and therefore doing the needful to see how we can serve his mission the best possible way today. And the last one is holy and deep personal commitment, experience in the company of authentic kindred spirits. So again, that has happened. No? This again goes back to the idea of sadhu sangha, swajatiya sadhu sangha, like-minded comrades through with which we have experienced very sacred moments of the epiphany and commitment with this ideal, and we continue to do so. So I hope you are all of them. All of you are those as well. So thank you so much for your association. So that's some brief words regarding my yes list. Like I mentioned, for the last decades of my lecture, I've tried to explain in detail those incredible points. Not so incredibly, but the points in itself are incredible. So anyhow, in conclusion, just to conclude and finish our lecture today, putting all the above reasons combined, all the 10 no's, all the 10 yes, I personally choose not to leave Gaudiya Vaishnavism. I personally choose not to live silently. And I personally choose not to live loudly. But I choose to stay as a Gaudiya. Not silently either, but loudly. No, but not loudly as a rebel without a caste, an anarchic, throwing stones guy, but in service to the Sampradaya, but trying to share and explain whatever I feel personally as important. And I beg your forgiveness if any of my words are wrong or causing any anxiety. I'm willing to learn and change with all of you together. But that's the position I'm in the present day, choosing not to leave Gaudiya Vaishnavism, staying, but at the same time voicing some concerns that come to my heart. And remember, this is not all about leaving our legacy, but loving our legacy, if you want to make a play of words. Not about leaving, it's about loving. Not about leaving, but about learning how to stay with the proper reasons, as we say before. Not how to stay with the wrong reasons, but how to stay with the proper reasons. And address those things which require transformation, which require adjustment, review, so we can stay in a healthy way. So we can belong in a deep way, belong deeply. So we are not coming here to transform everything, but to renew those things that need to be renewed. And that's a commitment for all of us as members of the Sampradaya. I remember Christ saying, I didn't come here to modify the law, but to renew the law. So the law, the ancient Anadi revelation, if you will, it's there. Similarly, in Mahaprabhu's times, there was Vaishnavism, not Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but Vaishnavism. The old Vedic law was there. And the worship of Krishna and the Bhagavad was there. In its own way, a New Testament. But the way Mahaprabhu embraced the Bhagavad was in one sense something new even, another New Testament. But in another sense, it was not a change of the law, it was a renewal of the old law, an upgrading, all of which was replaced, quote-unquote, by his doctrine of love. That's what we are celebrating as Gaudiya Vaishnavas. But in doing so, in Mahaprabhu engaging in that renewal, he was fully supported by the old tradition and revelation. It was not independent from that. So in this way, Shastan tradition can be understood, of course, from stagnated ways. And Parampara can get stuck. Krishna himself said that in the Gita. So that's not something new. But Mahaprabhu showed examples to Krishna himself by showing a deep renewal of this stagnation, of how people at his times were understanding Shastra and tradition in a not very dynamic way. And when the contemporary people in Mahaprabhu's time, some of them at least, saw such a renewal coming from Gaur Chandra and his Sampradaya, many Hindus felt threatened. Not even Muslims, but three Hindus as well. And they attacked his movement in his contemporary times. Like it happened with Jesus in his own time, like it happened with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's innovation, so many times attacking people, attacking him, almost all of the doors of the Vrindavan temples being closed in protest to him, except for one. When Srila Prabhupada came to the West and made so necessary and incredible presentation and adjustment, so many criticized that. So that pattern is always there. The need for reform or renewal, the criticism of contemporaries. So the pattern is always there of potential stagnation and always require proper action to deal with that. So the question, of course, just to conclude today's lecture is, which form that pattern is taking today and what's the necessity of the moment? So I leave you with that question, again, in the spirit of collective introspection. We will conclude our class here today. And now as homework, apart from this question, we have, as I already mentioned before, if you want, if you like, make your own list of reasons why to stay, why to leave as a Gaudiya Vaishnava, and why to stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnava, most importantly. And not only make a list, take your time and deeply reflect upon that. If you want, you can share that. And in a way that we can hopefully stay as Gaudiyas, but again, for the right reasons. So thank you so much for your time. If there are any questions or comments, you can leave them on the thread via Facebook or YouTube, and we'll try to address them throughout the week till and in the way that the whole discussion continues unfolding and overflowing to our next meeting next Tuesday. The topic of next class will be vulnerability and empowerment in connection to all this, no? In connection to the stance that we need to take as individuals, as a group, to open ourselves to what needs to be changed. We call that vulnerability, to expose in that way, and which will be the result of that openness, of that vulnerability in the form of empowerment. So thank you so much. See you next week. Shriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Gaudiya Sampradaya ki jai, Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Priman Haribo, Pancha Kalpatarubhish, Kripa Sindhuvyaibhish, Patitanam Pavanevya Vaishnavipya Namo Nama, Ananta Koti Vaishnavrinda ki jai, Gaur Haribo.